Welcome back to another episode of the Bigger Than Me podcast. Here is your host, Aaron.
It is the new year. I am so excited to be kicking this episode off all about how we can improve ourselves physically, mentally, emotionally, how we can grow as individuals and behave in a way that is bigger than ourselves. My guest today is the great Ayman Zahabi. Ayman Zahabi, it is such a pleasure to sit back down with you. It has been so long since we talked. Would you mind just briefly reintroducing yourself for people who might not be acquainted with your work?
Yeah, so I'm Ayman Zahabi. I'm a professional fighter. I fight in the UFC. I've had a lifetime experience of training in martial arts. And currently I'm on a 3-fight winning streak with the UFC.
Last we spoke, you were heading into UFC Vancouver, and I was so excited. I got to sit there live and watch you perform, which was such an honor. Would you mind taking us back, going into that fight, and how you were feeling?
Well, leading up to the fight, given my opponent's history, like his, he has like 33 fights or like 32 fights when he was coming into that fight, he goes the distance a lot, and he's a hard-nosed fighter, and he has a really good right hand. So for the 2 months leading up, my brother was really getting me ready for war. Like he told me it's gonna be 15 minutes of hell. So I prepared myself mentally for that. Like I had the guys torturing me in sparring and in wrestling and in training and jiu-jitsu. And I went to like this the Montreal Wrestling Club, which like it's home to like a lot of the national wrestlers for Canada. So they're throwing me around the room because I heard in one of the fights when Eric Lang was fighting, one of the commentators said that his dad was like this really good wrestler. So I was like, okay, maybe he has that in his mind to take me down because you know not too many people have seen me on the ground. So I was like, okay, I'm going to prepare for that as well. So just getting my whole game ready. And then luckily he finished in a minute. So I was really happy. So, you know, you prepare for the worst and you hope for the best. And this time the best happened for me.
That's one area I feel like we don't hear a lot about is the process of trying to figure out what your opponent is preparing for and how they want the fight to go and how you want the fight to go. How much time is dedicated to trying to figure out what their game plan might be and preparing for contingencies?
You know, it's interesting because like I always plan for my opponents and I try to stick to that plan like hardcore, like in my mind to like not deviate from what I'm supposed to do. And then now, like my last 3 fights, I really realized that other guys are game planning for me just as much as I want to game plan for them. So I have to be careful and not be too stuck on my game plan. Because if I come expecting them to do something and they change it, I have to be have the flexibility of mind to adapt to the situation. So I really didn't expect Eric Lang to throw low kicks because I thought he'd be worried about me taking him down because I'm black belt in jiu-jitsu. So I was like, there's no way he's going to kick my leg. He's going to wait to hit me with a right hand. Like you've seen me get knocked out in the past and he has a really good counter right hand. And I thought that was his best way to win was to counter me with his biggest punch. And instead he came out kicking. So, you know, I just had to adapt on in the moment and I hit him with a nice counter. So I was really happy, you know, because, you know, there's that Mayweather is really famous for saying this. He says, true check. Champions adapt. They can adapt to anything, you know? So like, I'm really just trying to adapt in my fights as much as possible.
Yeah. So you have all of that groundwork and then you're going in and you're kind of open. You have your kind of what you want to have happen, but you're open to what's going to happen. And it ends up sometimes working out way better. You're not in a 3-round long 15-minute war. You're in a very quick fight. What was the feelings afterwards?
Oh, incredible. Incredible feelings. I was super, super happy because there is a relief in the sense that when you don't take the damage, and I had prepared myself to be ready for lots of damage after this fight. You know, they call him the Mongolian murderer, and you watch his fights, they get very intense. You know, he doesn't usually go down. He marks guys up, he hurts them, he gets hurt. Like it's like a barn burner type fight. So I prepared myself mentally to like end up in the hospital, you know, in that night, you know, like with cuts or something. I thought something was going to happen. And then like when I dropped him, I put my hands up like in my, like the way I saw him fall, I knew he was done, but the referee didn't come in. So I had to jump on him. But first you get a wave of relief that there's no damage and then you get the joy of winning. And then it was really cool because like when Firas came out and he gave me that hug in the cage, he told me, if you would have let him up, I would have slapped you. I said, yes, I know. I finished the job. I got on top of him and I finished. It's happened before. You know, when guys, they raise their hands, they think the guy's done. The guy gets up, fight continues. Yeah. Would have been very embarrassing. Firas would have beaten me.
And then knowing that you were also a part of a night where all the Canadians won and you got to continue to see the night go on and the Canadians take over and show out on that night, what was that experience like to be a part of a team doing that, Canadians doing that?
Honestly, it was an honor because I feel like it's going to be a historical moment because it was the first time on a UFC card all the Canadians won. You know, there's usually one loses, maybe two, who knows. But it's a really historical moment for Canadians. And I feel like it really helped bring more fans into it from Canada. Because, like, MMA was dying out in Canada a little bit. And I feel like it gave us a resurgence. And now, like, one of the UFC staff members was saying how they might come to Canada 2 to 4 times a year in 2024 going forward. So I feel like that night, all six of us really played a big hand in that. So I'm happy to be part of that.
And do you have a close relationship with the other fighters going into that night? Are you all on the same page or what was that process? Because we look at it from our perspective and we see all the Canadians win. It seems like you're all on the same team.
Yeah. Well, internationally, for sure, we're all on the same team. And like some of those guys I've trained with before, they've come to the gym to come at TriStar before. And some of them I hadn't met. I met them that night. But it was really cool to like go to the hotel and see them after. Because, you know, like the UFC now, since COVID, the policy is there's no green room. So they ask you to leave after the fight. And so when I was going back to the hotel, after each fight, the Canadians were coming back. We got to take some pictures together and with the fans and holding up Canadian flags. So like that was cool. The very nice moments we got to share.
What is the process afterwards? I just started a new job and immediately my brain starts going like, where do I want to go from here? What do I want to do next? How do I want to get there? What are the next big step ups where I can continue on my career, but also take care of the family? What is your process? Once you get that win, what are you thinking of?
Well, I'm excited to get another fight and I'm excited to just keep the ball rolling, you know? And it was weird. Like for me, I had a moment in training camp. I had like this mental hurdle where I was like, oh man, I want 2 in a row already. Maybe I won't win 3 in a row. It's like a big ask to win 3 in a row in the UFC. And I was having a hard time dealing with that. And I brought it up to Firas. I remember I'm like, you think I can win 3 in a row? He's like, what are you talking about? It has nothing to do with any of the last two fights. Each fight is its own. There's no such thing. There's no curses. There's no you run out of luck. There's none of that. He's like, you train your best. You do your best. Whether you win or lose, it doesn't matter to us. And just go out there and do your best. You know, so he just reminded me to just not care about those things. Like, don't worry about the statistics. You know, a lot of times statistics, they get it wrong, right? It's good to look back and you can make the statistics say whatever you want, but you shouldn't let it affect your mentality going in.
Actually, one of my favorite rappers, Big Sean, has a line and he was like, I was trusting statistics more than I trusted me, talking about like the rates of black incarceration and the challenges they face. And rather than trusting your own ability to grow and develop and succeed.
Yeah, because you hear about stats all the time, especially like from like the commentators and the analysts and the YouTube guys and all this stuff. They're like, yeah, this guy's this many stats, this many punches per second. So they're this and blah, blah, blah. But in the end, man, you don't know what's going to happen in there until it happens, you know? And there are so many ways to win in MMA and so many ways to lose that, you know, it's you have to go out there and just be yourself and do it. And the outcome will be what it is.
Are you going to be at UFC Toronto?
I don't know yet. I haven't been on the card yet. Like, I didn't get a fight or anything yet. But Arnold Allen is getting ready to fight on the card. And maybe I'll go to show him some support. If he might ask me to be in his corner or not. I don't know. Or if not, I might just come and watch the show, like, as a fan.
How does it feel to have it right in your backyard now, traveling, obviously, across the country to come to Vancouver?
Oh, it's great. That's one of the reasons why I want to kind of fight on the card, because, like, for the people from Montreal, it's super easy to get there. Like, you can leave Saturday morning and come back Sunday. It's like a one-night trip, one-night hotel stay, whereas Vancouver, it's much further. Cost plane tickets, the hotels are more expensive and all those things. So I was looking forward to trying to get on the card so that more friends and family can come live. But, like, now instead of, like, watching me, I guess we'll all go and we'll all support Arnold for sure.
That's fantastic. And what else has been going on in the past couple of months since we spoke last? Anything new?
Well, I took the kids to Florida, actually, my wife and kids. My wife had like a work conference out there. So we decided to go and use it to go to Disney World. So I ended up taking my kids there. Had a beautiful day. We went there for one day, 15 hours. Let me tell you, 8:30 in the morning to 11:30 at night. Oh, I'm done. I never got to go back. We did everything we could.
That's fantastic. You got to be exhausted after that, right?
Yeah, it was exhausting, but it was great. You know, my kids were soldiers that day. They're 5 years old, both of them, right? They're twins, and no stroller needed. They walked all day. they're happy. They ate well. They didn't give me a hard time. So I'm really happy with them.
Yeah, that you should be. Since we last spoke, I talked to your twin, Ariel Helwani, and that was such a trip.
Yeah, tell me, what was that? That's a big fish, man.
It was a huge fish. So I listen to the show all the time and enjoy getting his takes on things. I try and develop, and I've learned a lot through his style of interviewing, how he approaches it, and I kind of study what he does, because I think he's really good at interviewing people, asking good questions, and being a good journalist. And so he has the Q&As at the end of his Wednesday episodes, and I'd put in the odd question for him and try and make sure it's thoughtful, not ask every week. And over time, he started to notice. On Twitter, I'd comment on some of his stuff, and then I just kind of reached out and was like, hey, like, I get you're busy, you're being a host of shows of different events and stuff, and so I get you might not have the time, but it would be an honor to try and hone my skills and ask you questions about how you interview people. And he was like, let's run it. And so a few times of trying to go back and forth, find times, and he texted me on the day of and was like, hey, could you do it at 12 o'clock today? And it was like in 48 minutes, so I had to message him and go, hey, like, are we able to run this? Like, I haven't prepared, but like, I'd like to do this interview. This is a once in a lifetime opportunity, might not get it again. And we ended up making it work.
That's amazing, man. Yeah, that's really, really cool. Especially that you stayed so persistent and he noticed, man, that's great that he gave you a great time, a chance to shine, you know, to really get somebody that's like big in our industry.
It speaks to the fact that, like, people are of good character. I know he gets a lot of flack from different fighters or from different individuals within the UFC or different promotions, but it shows that, like, when it comes down to it, giving me the opportunity, I'm not some big name. He's not doing it because he's going to get 10 million followers on Twitter or something. He's doing it to show support and show love for the next generation of potential interviewers.
Yeah, you know what's funny is that, like, you're not going to be liked by everyone. And if you accept that, then you can always be who you are. You know what I mean? So, like, yeah, I'm sure if Ariel rubs some people the wrong way, that's okay. I mean, that's life, man. I probably rub a lot of people the wrong way too. But I'm sure a lot of people, he has a huge fan base, you know? So he must be doing something right to get that big of a fan base. And, you know, when it comes to the fighters, like, I don't follow the drama that he has with a lot of fighters, but a lot of fighters seem to like him as well. You know, so sometimes it's a two-way street. Who knows what happened? I don't know. I don't follow all those stories. But if he's true to himself, he's going to have people that don't like him. And if he's going to have people that love him at the same time. You know, that's just part of being an adult.
Yeah, it's a scaling problem too, right? When you're dealing with the people within your family, like, that's not a lot of people. But then when you start to deal with 1,000 people, 10,000 people, the odds that one person is going to dislike you and just for no good reason, that's going to scale upwards. And then when you have people watching your videos and it's a million people, the odds that there's going to be a group of people who don't like you is going to be higher. But I think that that's something our brains aren't really adapted to, because we're used to interacting with people. You're not used to those comments, where now you're starting to take it personally.
Yeah, exactly. And look, how social media is not that old either. And a lot of people have haters. Like, let's say, I don't know, for example, let's say Kim Kardashian. She's like a mega star on social media. Yeah. How many people love her? Like, she has like one of the most biggest, largest following. And how many people in the world hate her, you know? And then she's just being herself, really. And I feel like Ariel has millions of fans. Yeah. She's going to have a couple hundred thousand haters.
It's normal. Exactly.
I feel like it comes with having a lot of fans.
Yeah. But I find him super inspirational, and the way that I feel like he interviews so many fighters is different than what you get at the press conferences. And it's not that the press conferences aren't like valuable, but his approach of like really getting to the heart of a person is so much more genuine and sincere, and gets me really invested in fighters and what's going on.
Yeah, I agree. Like, I was talking with you when you interviewed me last time. It's like a breath of fresh air when you ask me questions that aren't just so superficial, you know, and that you try to get your fans and my fans, because we're working together, to get to know me beyond just, oh, how many fights do you have? Oh, yeah, okay, you won your last fight. Okay, tell us about your reaction. Okay, blah, blah, blah. But what else is going on in your life? How do you develop this? How do you do that? How do you think about the situation? You know, you get into my thoughts. And I feel like Ariel does that really, really well, too.
Agreed.
Right? That's why he's so big, because he asks the questions that most regular journalists don't ask. You know?
The human questions, the real questions that I feel like we want the answer to. And that's why I was so interested in sitting down with you, was because I really like walked away from our conversation being like, this person has a really strong philosophy, like something that grounds you beyond just the day to day, whatever's new and shiny, the newest iPhone. Like, you have a way of thinking about things that grounds you. And I find that so many people don't have that. So that when they see the new iPhone commercial, they're like, oh, I need to get that because that's what the commercial is telling me I need, rather than being able to zoom out and look at how you impact your loved ones, how you impact your community, how you impact your fans, how you, like, you understand kind of your role in the world in a different way than I find other people do.
Yeah, and that's why I kind of would like talk about different things, like that's my philosophies, then always answer the same basic questions, basically. So that's why it's interesting. I love getting on here with you, or with Ariel too. Actually, you always ask me really in-depth questions and you choose to get a different angle so people get to know me more personally and what it's like to be around me, you know, around being my friends, but even though we're not close, right? So I find that that's a better approach to interviewing fighters. And I feel like people who go down that route to personalize athletes will have a bigger following in the end as well.
I agree. That emotional connection, like watching you fight after speaking with you and after hearing your story, I was way more like, my hands were getting sweaty. Like I was like, oh my gosh, here we go. And you had
Aaron,
talked about
it. Imagine my wife, man. Imagine my wife.
I can't imagine what it's like to be them, to be in the arena right there and knowing you every single day and seeing you go into that circumstance all by yourself. Like when you talked about that in the interview and then being there, it was like, this is so surreal to sit here and know that I talked to this person and know that they're going into a war. And then you won, and I was super happy and grateful that you didn't take any damage. But it was such a different experience.
Yeah, no, for sure. And you know what's funny? Talking about like my wife, like before COVID, she had come to all my fights since I'm like 15 or 16. But during COVID, she wasn't able to come to the Draco fight because of the rules and whatever, blah, blah, blah. But now I'm on a hot streak. So I told her, listen, man, you ain't coming. That's it. It's done until this hot streak is broken. Even though we're not really supposed to believe in those things.
Yeah.
But like, I did notice that it's just like way less stressful for me to not have her there fight week, because you know MMA fans in the arena, they get wasted, and you know there could be a lot of aggression in the stands and things like that. So like I used to always stay in the back of my head if she's okay, if she's all right, you know what I mean? Or I don't know, you know, because I know she's sitting with like either my brother, like not for us, but my other brother, and or like a couple of my friends or whatever. But you know, you never know what can happen in the audience. Like MMA crowd is still a rough crowd. They get rowdy, you know. It's like hardcore fans drink a lot of beer, and you know, things happen in there. So like actually I find it's more relaxing that she's at home, she's safe, and she's watching from TV. I feel much better about it.
I don't blame you. I was there and we were at the pre-fight press conference and there were some jabronis, if I can use that word.
Yeah, of course. There's going to be wild cats over there, man.
Screaming away, and they were just yelling Dana the whole time. And it was like, what are you, like, even if he responded to you, what are you going to say after that? There's no logic to this.
Nothing. There's no logic, but they're excited and we love them. I'm happy they're there. You know, I'm really happy they're there. But, you know, when you see fights happening, it feeds that inner beast, feeds that in you. And sometimes you might just want to throw a few hands. And it's happened a lot where brawls break out at MMA events. It happens all the time. It happens in NFL, happens at the NHL. People, you know, they get into disagreements. And, you know, MMA, it's a spot where it can happen.
Or the arena starts to fall apart on the person walking out.
Oh, my God. That was crazy, man. Who was that? Crazy. That was Mike Mallett, no?
Yeah.
Was it Mike? Yeah, it happened to him. Yeah, it was nuts. I was watching it on TV and I couldn't believe it.
It was stunning. And then to think that he just walks out and that he fights and he wins is just surreal.
His coach almost got crushed.
Yeah.
Which was hilarious. He didn't notice it was behind him, but it was just so funny. I was like, oh my God, they almost lost their coach there, bud.
And you know he zoned in when.
Yeah, exactly. You know what's funny? Another time when I fought in the Apex, one of the guys, when he was supposed to walk out, his opponent was already in the cage. Okay, his opponent was already in the cage. It's his turn to make the walkout. I think his back seized up and he couldn't walk, and then they canceled the fight. I don't know if you've heard about that.
No.
Yeah. I can't remember who it was. And the fight got canceled with his opponent in the cage.
Wow.
It's insane. Like, you never know what's going to happen in MMA. I'm telling you, man. Stadium's falling apart, guys getting spasms, it's a nightmare.
That's crazy. I had no idea. That's going to be such a trip to know that the fight could not happen while you're walking out.
While you're walking out, man.
Crazy. Are we able to explore, we're heading into the new year, and I'm just thinking about how people best maneuver this. There's arguments on the one hand that New Year's resolutions aren't necessary, that you should start the day you want to set a goal, you should start that day. You shouldn't put it off to some arbitrary date. But I do feel like there's value in us as a society all kind of agreeing that we're going to look at like where we're heading in life on this date, and we're going to try and take real steps. This isn't, I'm going to stop having chocolate bars tomorrow. This is more like, how do I improve myself, level up my life, over the next year and grow as a person this year? And how am I going to bring this new tool into my life? I'm just curious, how do you think about New Year's resolutions?
Well, it depends, you know, like, I don't like you said, you know, about putting that date, you know, I really feel like you don't need to wait until a date. Because in the end, the only way to achieve your goals is if you make the decision that you're going to work at it, you know? I don't believe in, like, somebody dragging you to the finish line. Nobody can motivate you. No date is going to motivate you, you know? Unless, let's say for me, fight night, I have to make my goal wait, right? So then it's like a deadline. A deadline is different than a starting point.
Right.
You know what I mean? So, like, if I were to try to motivate someone, right, in that sense, like motivate, I'd rather give them a deadline than to give them a starting point, because right, it doesn't matter where you start, yeah, it's when you how you finish,
right?
And the only way to create urgency is the deadline, because the starting point is always going to get pushed, right? They'll find 50,000 excuses. That's where, like, the whole problem with procrastination. It's not about starting, it's about giving yourself a time limit. And if the time limit can't motivate you, then you don't really want it, you know? Like, for women, let's say they want to fit in a certain dress in a certain size. That wedding date is the deadline. And most women, like, they're motivated now, you know? They're motivated. And they're going to get to that deadline no matter what it takes, because there's so many things you can do to achieve your goal, right? So let's say you want to lose weight. You can diet for a bit and then increase your training, and then you can increase the intensity of your diet, and then you could, you know, decrease your training a bit, increase your nutrition limits even more. And there's all these different calibrations you can do to get to your goal weight. But the whole point is to get to that weight by this date, right? You know? So, like, you don't have to start New Year's, but pick the day you want to finish your goal. You know, even if you start a week after New Year's, doesn't matter. Yeah. But let's say you say, okay, by June 1st, I'm going to be at this weight. Now, so it's like the stock market. So many things can go right and wrong up to that date. But you got to work your butt off to make sure that you get it by then, you know? And you should give yourself a repercussion. I'll give you a funny story. My brother, every year on his birthday, okay, he wants to be 9% body fat on his birthday. Every year. So that he never gets fat. Right. So he never gets lazy, right? So that's his deadline. Every year he's got a deadline, okay? If he doesn't make the weight, the percentage, the 9%, he owes his wife $1,000. Okay.
Wow.
But the $1,000, I think, has been cumulative. So since he hasn't missed it, that money is going up. Right. So I don't know if it's been 5 years now. I don't know when he came up with the idea, or 3 years. So, like, if he doesn't make it this birthday, he owes her a few grand. Right. You know what I mean? So he found something that hurts. It hurts inside. Like, you know, it doesn't hurt to give your wife money, but it's like, oh man, now I gotta give her 4K, or should I just make this weight?
Yeah.
But it's a funny thing that they have going again, you know. You know, she, like, she's obviously, she wants him to lose the weight, but she also, like, teases him, oh no, you know, you should have this piece of cake, you should have this, you know. So it's like it keeps the relationship fun. So I feel like if you have a spouse or whatever and you guys are working towards goals, it could be funny to have, like, little things like that, or it keeps the relationship funny, you know. And then in the end, like, you know, let's see, you lose the wager, your wife, she doesn't really, you know, it's like you're taking money from one pocket and putting it in another. It's not a really big deal, you know, but it's just funny to see who could make it.
And it's such a good point, because for so many goals, we don't have, like, if we don't reach it, nobody knows. It's something just kind of in our heads, which is why I think they recommend you tell people that you're setting this goal, so that you feel accountable, even if it's not good enough to be accountable just to yourself.
Yeah. And for me, my clients, let's say, for example, I take on a client, okay? I have a very, like, burn the ships method. Okay. So if they come on, they have to lose 1 pound a week. If you don't lose 1 pound a week two times, you're fired and you owe me $200, a $200 penalty, but I can't work with you anymore.
Right.
So you have to pay me for the program. Plus, if I train you personally, like, with the hours, and if you fail, you owe me more money. Nobody fails.
Yeah.
Why would they pay me to not lose weight?
Yeah.
Makes no sense. They should only pay me if they're losing the weight.
Yeah.
So they lose the weight because they don't want to pay me and gain weight.
Right.
You know? So that's kind of the idea. And then I give them a deadline. Okay, we're going to be this weight by every week, 1 pound. There's no ifs or buts. You don't make that pound, you owe me money. Right? Because I can't be more motivated than you. You know, so that's kind of like how I would work. I work with my team.
I think that that's so important because we do like to like offset our responsibilities to other people so that we don't feel that weight on our own shoulders. Like yeah. You're going to make me healthy, right? And like that's
you're
the only one who's going to control. Because like I often think about this. There's like this discussion around like overweight people and whether or not they know, whether or not it's healthy, whether or not it looks good. It's not healthy. But like the other piece that I always think of, because I was like really overweight for a period, was they know. Like when you go have dinner with somebody and then you leave and you go get a burger from McDonald's afterwards, you know you're being a fatty. Like there's no part of you that's eating that extra burger after having dinner and feeling like, no, this is a health move. Like I'm doing this because I care about myself. Like you know you're doing a guilty pleasure. And so much of that gets left out because it's healthy people saying like you're being unhealthy. But as like someone who was overweight, I knew in those moments like, no, you shouldn't get the fries, but I'll get a medium fries as well.
Exactly. And like for me, it comes down to like, I know the program works. So the program won't fail you. You fail the program. That's kind of the idea. So let's say you want to, you know, want to lose weight or you want to increase, I don't know, your productivity or whatever. You set your goals and you find a way to do it. And there's a million people who can do, teach you how to do everything you want on YouTube. There's so much information on Google. Now there's ChatGPT. You can learn basically almost anything for almost free. Like any skill, how to do anything, lose weight, lift weights, learn how to fight, learn how to be a journalist. You can learn how to do so many things on YouTube and Google and ChatGPT that the answers are out there. It's you who's not performing, you know?
I also feel like people sometimes, like they set the goal, I want to lose 15 pounds, but they need the understanding around it as well to like really get them motivated. So one of the things that like struck me was that if you're overweight and you have a kid, and you pass on the likelihood that they're going to be overweight as a consequence of you being overweight. And that's genetically passed down. And that blew my mind. So that's like a piece. And then you think about like, you want to be able to play with your kids. You want to be able to be healthy, live a long life. Like all these pieces you're taking away from, it's not just 15 pounds. It's a quality of life question.
Yeah. Well, let me ask you, do you have any kids, Aaron, or no? How old are you, man?
Not yet. I am 28 years old.
Oh, you're a young buck, man. You're a young buck. Well, listen, when you have kids one day, wouldn't you want them to have a good mentality, strong, a smart mind, educated? Okay. Wouldn't you want them to have a good spirit, good belief in something, something bigger than themselves, right? And wouldn't you want them to be healthy, physically healthy and fit?
Yeah.
So why wouldn't you want that for yourself? You know, if you want your kids to have it, you should have it. Because your kids, you know, like they don't only learn top down. You know, they don't only learn what you tell them. They watch your mannerisms. They watch your habits every day. They're asking you questions, little questions, and they're watching you. They're seeing how you live and how you act and how you order food and what you order and what you're doing and blah, 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 blah. And how you speak, self-talk is huge. You know, so and they're registering all this, right? They're subconscious like a supercomputer. So if you want them to be good in all these three facets of life, okay, you should be taking that on as well. You know, so it's very important to work on your mindset, to work on your health, and to work on your physicality. You need to be strong in all three. You know, I wouldn't want my kid to just be smart and be fat and have no spirit and like not care, not like believe in anything bigger than themselves. You know, they might end up nihilistic. They might end up super depressed and on hormones and all these things. I don't want any of that, man. I want them to be strong in all three facets so they can have a nice, healthy, beautiful life. That's kind of like the goal for the girls, you know?
I couldn't agree more. It reminds me of what Jordan Peterson talks about when he talks about this idea that we take better care of making sure our pets take their medication than we do of making sure we take care of our own bodies and make sure we're healthy, that we can care about something else, but to give that care to ourselves, we're not very good at.
Yeah, exactly. I feel like that's an issue with obviously a lot of parents for sure, but also team leaders, you know? So a lot of people are bosses. They're not really leaders, you know? Luckily for me, for us, a really good mentor, he's a great leader. You know, he fulfills those three assets, those three aspects of life. And he also helps educate the guys to have that going on at the same time. And like for me, it's almost like I have two lives. I have my career life and I have my family life. And I'm trying to excel at both parallel at the same time. You know, my fight life doesn't take away from my family life and vice versa. My family life never takes away from the fight life. But for me, that's what's being successful is I'm able to do both. You know, I didn't have to stop fighting to take care of my family, and I didn't have to, you know, leave my family to take care of fighting.
Right.
You know, I'm not abandoning them, and I'm not abandoning fighting either. I'm able to kind of like build both up at the same time. And it keeps me very busy for sure. And my wife's amazing. My wife's really, really good. She's doing the same thing. And I feel like that's how you got to live. You can't just focus on only one thing. You need your life and you need a way to generate income, right? And you have to have a passion. I was just talking to my daughters. My daughter was telling me yesterday, she's like, I don't know what I want to do. She's 5 years old. I don't know what I want to be. I don't know what I want to be. I think I'm going to be a singer. I think I'm going to be a doctor. I don't know, blah, blah, blah. And they said, whatever you choose, make sure you love it. Make sure you absolutely love it. It's something that you want to do. And then you become so good at it, everyone's willing to pay you to do it. That's it. You figure that out, you'll be fine. Things are going to be fine. Yeah.
That's a really good advice.
Yeah, thanks.
To wrap up the conversation on physicality, do you think that it's more useful if people are like, I want to lose weight, I want to get healthier, that they set the goal of like getting really good at boxing or trying out jujitsu or doing something where it's not as specifically about going to the gym every day, 5 days a week, or going for a run 5 days a week? Is there tools? How do people make sure that they stay accountable and at least move in that direction?
It's funny, as I talk to my nutritionist about this concept a lot. And one thing that I find that's really important is that you have to understand almost all the methods work. Okay? If you want to box to lose weight, you want to jiu-jitsu to lose weight, you want to go to the fitness room and lift weights to lose weight, or if you want to just only nutrition, you only focus on nutrition, you'll lose weight. If you want to do the Atkins diet, if you want to do the Dolce diet, if you want to do the Lockhart diet, if you want to do Jenny Craig, you want to do whatever, they all work. The only thing that doesn't work is you.
That's that? True.
So basically, the only answer is that you have to find the plan that you enjoy doing the most so you can sustain it. You know, like for me, in my experience, that people, the easiest way, the least painful way is fasting. Okay, it's the least painful way. Is it the only way? No. The reason why I think it's the least painful way is because me, I work with a lot of like businessmen and women, you know, and when I introduce fasting to them, they like it because they waste less time eating and going out to eat. They could spend more time working and less time preparing meals, right? And at a point when they fast for 36 hours or 42 hours, they only eat once every 2 days. Like now they're so much more productive.
Yeah.
And their mind is still clear and they're losing the weight. So it's like, it's hitting a lot of elements at the same time. So for me, I feel like fasting works a lot very well for like the business realm. But for some people, if let's say like you want to eat, you're used to eating 3-4 meals a day, you can still lose weight. If you have no access to gym, you can still lose weight. If you want to not change your diet, but you want to lose weight with fitness, you can find a trainer who can help you do that too. You know, but find the one that you can do every day happily and enjoy it. That way you won't quit. It's not about getting to the goal. It's about if you get to the goal and maintain it forever. Yeah. You gotta keep it going, you know?
That's the big challenge I faced when I was trying to lose weight, was like just hitting those plateaus and those, like if you hit it, you think you made it so you can go back to the way you were living, and you can't.
No, you can't. You can't. You have to make an adjustment, you know. That's why like fasting is really good. Because let's say you get deep into fasting, like you all of a sudden, like you're doing, you know, 2-3 days, you don't need to eat or whatever, blah, blah, blah. But then once you've attained your goal weight, okay, you can cycle back the length of fasting. So instead of doing like a couple of days, you can go back to 18 hour fasts, which is not a big deal. You basically skip breakfast and you have lunch a couple hours later, and then boom, that's 18 hours. And you won't put the weight back on really, really fast. And then if you notice, I gained like 3-4 pounds. Oh, you know what? I'm going to go on a 2-day fast. But now that you've developed the skills of fasting and the mentality, you know that you could just knock out a 2-day fast. But if you let it snowball to the point where it's a hill to climb to come back, it's a problem. You know, one of my teammates, okay, I bring him to all my fights. Every year, Neil's in my corner. Okay, every time I fight, he's in my corner. Every time I fight, he's motivated to lose the weight. After my fights, and he loses the weight. But then by the time my next fight, he's fat again. And I keep telling him, I'm like, Neil, it's not, being in shape is not hard. It's getting in shape. It's the getting. But once you're in shape, maintaining it is way easier than getting in shape. Getting in shape is hell.
Yeah.
So painful. It's so painful. The first few weeks of being back in the weight room, it's your muscles are sore. But if you never stopped, you don't get as sore anymore.
Do you eat anything or do anything? I don't know if you heard about what Dana White's doing. And he has this period of time where he's fasting, but then he goes, I think it's 72 hours, and then he's doing like a bone broth with it to make sure that he has nutrients.
I've done it before. I'm not doing fasting right now, but yes, I've done it. Bone broth is amazing. GSP's on a huge kick. I think he just did like a 3-day fast right now. He saw him on Instagram. He was posting about it. He had like a huge steak and bone marrow, two huge bone marrows for his, after 3 days of no eating. That's the first thing he ate, which is pretty cool. And that's another thing. Like when you don't eat for 3 days, when you have supper with your family, that's like an event.
Yeah.
You know, like sometimes like for example, one of the business guys I worked with, when he got down to not eating for 3 days, we'd only eat it two or three times. He'd eat like 3 times a week. I told him, listen, because he was worried about like not having supper with his kids every day. I said, listen, you don't have supper with your kids every day, but those 3 times that you have supper with them, you make them special. You know, there's no TV. You know, you and your wife can cook a special meal, or you can order a special meal, or on the weekend, let's say you're eating Saturday night, you take your whole family out to dinner. And then he realized, after a month or so of that, his kids were like, whoa, like, so nice to spend time with you. You're so much, it's much happier, so much more relaxed, and blah, blah, blah. So, you know, like, it pays dividends, you know, but they all do. But I'm just saying, like, that's another route. You know, fasting is just something I work with a lot. So, like, that's my experiences, but they all can be great.
That's one area where I do feel like we skip out a lot in Western culture, is that idea of having a meal together and making that special. And like, I grew up setting the table in a certain way. And like now it's like, I don't need to set the table, just put the fork on the plate. But there's something to that relationship with like, we're going to make this an experience, that this is going to be like a connecting moment where we're enjoying a meal. I tried something new. I made this weird lasagna. We're going to give that a try. I did my best on it, so I hope you like it. Like, there's an experience to try. Trusting people with food and sharing that kind of time together.
Well, it makes sense because now it's so easy to get food. I mean, for us, for the Western culture, it's so easy. You can eat all day. Like my kids, if they wanted, they could snack all day. Like they ain't going starving. Like we got supermarkets, we got restaurants, and it's not super expensive compared to like back in the day, you know, like let's say for my parents' generation, my parents didn't go to restaurants all the time.
Yeah.
You know, my mom cooked a lot at home. My mom was a stay-at-home mom. She cooked a lot of time at home. And, you know, times are hard. Like, my parents were immigrants. They came here with nothing. So, like, they're happy to have a meal. They're happy to sit down with the family and be able to afford the meal, right? They came from nothing. And I just feel like now, you know, there is kind of like a really nice standard of living in Western culture, you know? And I just feel like, you know, it's not as appreciated, which is normal, because now it's so easy. It's just so easy. But listen, don't eat for 3 days and tell me if eating a meal is something special or not.
I will give that a try.
Then you'll feel like it's special. Then you'll feel like, wow, this is really nice.
I'll make you a deal. I will do that. And the next time you come on, I will tell you what that experience was like. Because I've never done a 3-day fast before. I've never done
72 hours, man. You do 72 hours and record your reaction to sitting down and eating. Let me tell you, you're going to feel bliss.
I usually do like the 1 day and like have just dinner. And then I haven't eaten, and then the next day. I'm usually pretty good at that. And there is something to not giving your body anything. Like there's something, if you have a granola bar or something, it's broken and now your metabolism's running and it wants food. And like now you're hungry. But there's something to like, you've lasted so long and I do feel so much sharper. So I am actually curious about the results that that will bring.
You should do it, because also what's interesting about fasting is your stomach, it shrinks.
Yeah.
Right? It gets smaller and smaller. And you get used to eating less food. So you get by on less. And you can last longer because your body is covered in energy. All those fat stores, right? If we figured this out years ago, man, that your body stores fat for energy, but nobody's using it. You know, it's a funny thing. But what are you storing it for, man? You don't need it. You're charging your battery every 3-4 hours. You're eating your food. You're putting all this energy in. You got to use it, man. And on that 72-hour fast, you're going to see there's going to be a huge wave of hunger. But that huge wave of hunger that comes, it's more habit than it is physical pain.
Yeah.
And if you can believe in that and trust in that, it's your hunger pains are really a habit pain and not a physical pain, you'll get to the 72.
That that's what I've heard, is that you start to look at the signs and you start to look at the food and you see the ads and you start to realize how much you've just acclimated to this. I have lunch every single day. I have dinner every single day. I eat food for breakfast every single day. And how much slower you feel when you're doing that. Like, there's this old rule of 3 meals a day, and that's just hogwash.
Yeah, it doesn't make any sense. I mean, it depends, you know? Like me, when I'm getting ready for a fight, I don't fast because I want the energy for practice. So I eat 3 meals and 3 snacks, but they're very small meals. But basically the idea for my nutrition plan for, let's say, fight camp is to not spike my insulin, right? So I'm just trying to keep my insulin really, really low the whole day, right? That's another way. Like I'm telling you, there's so many ways to do it. I'm not just trying to promote fasting only, right? Because fasting is just one way. I just find it convenient if you're very busy and you have a million things to do in your life and you have a family, business and kids and all these different things going on, juggling on. Fasting, it actually requires you to do less work, less cooking, less cleaning dishes, less spending time at the restaurants or at the table. Yeah. So I just find it so convenient, but you could do it in different ways.
So if I do the 72-hour fast, should I be doing the bone broth? Is that something I should be having? No?
I mean, you know, listen, okay?
Okay.
Dr. Jason Fong is a doctor in Toronto, and he's like kind of the guy pioneering, like bringing all the science to fasting to the forefront. You know, he's like really the guy, the go-to guy. And in one of his books, he talks about you shouldn't have any of the bone broth until you have like a fast that's over 48 hours. Okay. But it's because you're going to go for 4 days, 5 days, 6 days, 7 days. But if you're stopping at 72, in my opinion,
okay,
you don't need it.
Yeah, I'm here for doctors the hobby right here. I'm ready for it. I'll trust your judgment, man. You've done it.
I don't think you need it. I think you got everything you got inside.
Okay, we're all up here, right?
You got all in there, man. You know, and listen, I don't know if you should check this guy out, okay? He is very funny. He's a YouTuber. I think his YouTube thing is called The Fasting Fat Man. I don't know if you've heard of him.
I have not, no.
Okay, he's got a crazy amount of viewers now. Basically, he was like 500 pounds and he had a son, and the story goes something like his son had just started crawling and he was sitting on the couch and his son was about to crawl down the stairs, like to go to the basement. Yeah. And he wanted to get up and stop his son from crawling down the stairs and fall down, but he couldn't get off the couch. Wow. He was struggling. He couldn't stand up. Finally, he lays down, rolls off the couch, and bear crawls until he grabs his son. He grabs his son by the ankle and saves him from going down the stairs, okay? So he was like, I can't believe it. I'm so fat now that I can't even help my own son, right? You know? So it motivated him. Anyways, so this guy decides to go fast. He didn't eat for 150 days. 150 days, no food. But he was being followed by a doctor and he was documenting on YouTube. That's something he became like super, super popular, right? So he's doing like all these vlogs and these different things, and he's like keeping people up to date on what's going on, what he feels. So he was having like some supplements, salt and bone broth. That's it. But no actual food. And that's okay because you need those, you need salt, you need the sodium, you need some proteins, but he's doing nothing that spikes his insulin.
Right.
Right, so he's trying to keep his insulin really, really low and fast. And he lost something like 230 pounds in 150 days. I can't remember the numbers exactly, but it's an amazing amount of weight. Uh-huh. And when he stopped at 150 days, he just started scaling down. So instead of like not eating ever, he was eating every 24 hours. Like now, I haven't been following him since, right. But he's very inspirational because he is really confident in himself that he's able to make jokes about the situation, you know, and he calls himself the fasting fat man. I'm not calling him fat, you know, but he finds a way to make humor out of it.
Right.
And he's very relatable to the average person because a lot of people are heavier than they want to be. And this guy was 500 pounds. Like this guy is at an extreme, a crazy extreme. And he got down to 200, you know, so to lose 300 pounds and to do it with a smile and to be joking, like for me, I really feel like he's an inspiration.
I couldn't agree more. And he's, I'm sure, thick boned, right? That's what I've
really said. Big guy. Really big guy. Very big guy.
Okay, the other thing I want to accomplish in 2024 is start doing this cold plunge thing. I want to fit in. I want to try this cold plunge thing, but it seems cold. And
like the cold. Some guys, they take it too far. Like, listen, I'm a little princess in the cold, but what can I tell you? Like me, I get into that cold plunge at 10 degrees. I feel like that's like my magic number.
Right.
And some guys, they take it too far. I don't know why they go colder. I don't think you need any colder than that, man. I think the science is in. 10 degrees, you know, you're not going to get like any frostbite, and you're not going to get any mental issues. You're not going to faint in there. You're not going to have a hard time. But some of these guys, they take it to like 5 degrees, 4 degrees. I think it's just a little bit too cold. Try 10 and let me know how that goes.
What do you use? Do you have one of those tubs? How do you approach it?
No, like me, like let's say when I have fight camp. When I have fight camp, I go to this. There's a spa here near my house.
Right.
And they have like the jacuzzi, the dry sauna, they have like a steam room, and then they have like these quiet rooms, and then they also have ice baths like around the different areas. So basically me, what I do is, let's say like every week before a fight for 8 weeks, every Saturday I go to the spa, I do 45 minutes in the jacuzzi, then I go 10 minutes in the sauna, then I do 10 minutes in the ice, then I do it again. Wow. Yeah, and then I do it again, that's it, done. But 10 degrees, listen, if you're in 10 degrees, you can do 10 minutes.
Yeah.
Anything under 10 degrees, you're not staying there very long. So, like, I don't know. That's the trade-off for me. I found the temperature that it's really cold, but I can stay in it, sustain it. Or a lot of guys, what they do is they go even colder, say 5 degrees or 4 degrees, but they're in and out in 20 seconds.
Yeah.
So I don't know scientifically what's better. But for me, for the mental challenge, I like sitting in there and like withstanding the cold for a long period of time. It just helps me get ready for the fight, I find.
That's what I was going to ask. Is it more a mental game or is it a physical challenge? What is it more of?
Like in the 10 degrees, I feel like it's a nice mix of both.
Okay.
Whereas anything higher than 10, it's not cold enough. But anything lower, it's going to be very hard to stay a long time. And you don't want to do something that's too hard that might actually make your mental game worse, push you down. Like if I go in a 2 degree ice bath and I know I can't stay more than 30 seconds, I don't feel tough.
Yeah.
I don't feel like I'm overcoming anything. I'm in and out.
Yeah.
Sucks. And I think there are some studies coming out that you can't be in too cold for too long.
Right.
So you have to be careful. There could be some damage in there. So I don't know. I don't know all the science. Maybe Huberman's talking about it. I don't know. I got to find that.
Oh, but, he's fantastic.
I like the 10 degrees aspect.
Okay, my next question is around the mental game. I find, as I said, you have a really strong philosophy. So I'm just wondering, how can people start on this journey? I know a lot of goobers that aren't as thoughtful and they don't think as critically. Where would you recommend people start their journey if they're serious about growing their mental game, being able to think of things bigger than themselves? How do they move in that direction?
There's a lot of different ways, you know, and I feel like a lost art in a lot of ways is finding a good mentor, you know. I think there's more in mentorship than people give way to these days. If you look at back in the day, you know, especially like during the Renaissance, it was all about mentorship. You learn from a master. You go in there and you do what he tells you. You know, if he's an artist, you're handing him those paintbrushes. You're cleaning up after him. You're doing all these things, but you're watching him do the strokes. He's talking to you. He's telling you how he's doing the strokes. You watch how he lives his life. You watch blah, blah, blah. And you start to pick up those things like a child would from their parents. You know what I mean? And it was funny because, like, I remember I was having a conversation. We're always talking about the kids, okay? And in my family, like my side of the family, we're always like, come up with ideas like, oh, what did you do? Like, how are you trying to solve this problem? Like, if this comes up and blah, 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 planning for the future, 10 years ahead. I was like, okay, what if my daughters, you know, when it comes to like the teenage phase, they start like giving me issues, right? Let's say they start becoming like bad girls or whatever. I don't know what. They get into the wrong things, or maybe they get into like friends who do drugs, and I'm worried about them. What am I going to do? I was thinking, man, maybe I could find them someone that I know within like my network, who I think is a great mentor, who could has the potential. Maybe they're not doing mentorships, but has the potential to mentor. Maybe that's somebody I can reach out to and be like, hey, listen, would you take my daughter on as an apprentice? You don't have to pay her, this and that, blah, blah, blah. And I'll find incentives for my daughters to go along, whether she wants, whether they want like money per achievement or whatever, if they want to like have a car by that age, or if they want to do a trip or something. I can use, you know, a carrot to motivate them through the process, and then I'm also gonna have a stick for it if they don't want to, you know. Yeah. So it's gotta be like a, you know, you need to have both, right? So like that, for me, I really feel like finding the people that are doing it already and emulating them and learning from them. And there are people in your network, I don't care who you are, you know, a friend of a friend who's doing it, who's making it happen, you know, and you could be a part of that. All you have to do is ask. A lot of the times, if you don't ask, you don't know whether or not they would do it. You just go up there and ask. And doing something for free could make you a lot more money than working minimum wage.
Yeah.
You know, so mentorship is huge for me. And I really feel like it's a lost art. It's really a lost art.
Man, I vibe with that so much, because one of the reasons I started this, I didn't have a dad growing up. And so one of my things was like, there are all these things that I don't know about. And when I went skiing as a kid, I wore jeans because I didn't know I needed to wear pants, because I didn't have that role model saying, this is how you gear up, this is how you set up. I didn't have somebody who taught me, this is what a healthy meal looks like, this is how you eat, and you want to make sure there's vegetables, and it's not just because they taste bad, it's because it gives you the nutrients your body needs. I didn't learn any of that. So when I started the podcast, the sense was like, I want to know things that I didn't know before, to gain information and have a deeper understanding, have that philosophy, live a healthy life, and share these people I think are admirable with other people, so you can follow their journey and get inspired by them, and maybe take that step in your own life that people aren't making. And within my Indigenous community, I know there's the biggest challenge is there isn't that role model next door. We have reservations where everybody's in the same boat. Everybody's on social assistance. Everybody doesn't have a job. Everybody has a piece of crap car. They're all in the similar boat. And if you brought somebody outside of that and said, here's a lawyer, get to know them. Maybe that's not your thing. Maybe we bring in a dentist. Maybe we bring in an architect and learn from these people. And maybe that's not your vibe, but seeing them be passionate will make you passionate too. And that's what I really wanted to make this platform all about, is inspiring people to reach for more and try and make a difference and grow within themselves in a different way than I think we get so used to. So you saying that really resonates with me.
Well, I think you're doing a great job, man. That's awesome. I didn't know about the not having a father, but that's incredible. You're really growing up to be a man too, right? Look at you. You're super successful. You're doing great. Thanks. And I do agree with your idea of, let's say, like, bringing in lawyers to the community, and like people, like you have to bring in, like you said, the person that's passionate. That passion, that can rub off on a young mind.
Yeah.
You know what I mean? But like you said, if the kid has no interest in lawyers, okay, then you bring a dentist, and then you bring in a restaurateur, like an entrepreneur who opens a restaurant. There's some guys who are amazing at open restaurants, man.
Yeah.
Some guys are amazing at doing whatever. You have to find the things that motivates the kid, that's what he's into already, something he's into. You know, maybe those kids are amazing at drawing. Who knows? You bring in an artist who can draw and teach a kid's class, blah, blah, whatever. I can remember one of my nephews was super into graffiti, right? And my brother found a school, not a school, but like a lady who teaches kids how to do graffiti. And like to pass their final exam or whatever, and like it was like a summer program or whatever, they had to go and graffiti a wall that they had, and they had to make an art piece and whatever. But it's just something to motivate them, and he got to be inspired by someone who that's something they're really good at. And I agree with you, man. And I think that's something the Indigenous communities need more of, is more people coming in and inspiring them to get out of those, you know, those things. And hopefully more can be done.
Hopefully the other piece that I feel like resonated with me or shaped me was I got to visit my First Nation community and understand what the living circumstances were there. And then I got to go visit my family in White Rock, who lived in like a $1.3 million home and had the really nice neighborhood. So I got like a really strong understanding of like what poverty and what adversity looks like, and what success and financial comfort and financial freedom looks like. So I just find that I'm constantly wanting to work on things and grow things and develop things. Yeah. And then other people are like, I don't know why you work so hard. Like, why don't you just take a break? And it's like, but there's just pure opportunity. If you just put in the work, if you just put in the effort, you're going to get so much farther than the people who are sitting on their couches watching another rerun of The Office or Friends or whatever it is. You're going to be moving ahead gradually past them, and the doors are limitless to where you can take your own life.
I agree totally. And I like the idea that you said you had the contrast of the two lives, you know, and it's interesting because it's more like in the United States, but a lot of millionaires in the United States come from nothing. something like 71% of millionaires in the United States came from nothing, which is incredible. And let's say if you could do that in one generation, as one, like you started for your family to become a millionaire from nothing, you know, maybe that's something that we should introduce to kids in poverty. Be like, listen, I know you, like, your circumstances aren't the best, but you go meet people who started from similar and you get that story from them. How did they make it? What motivated them? How did they put things together to make it work? You know, and maybe those small habits that those other people were able to accomplish, they can accomplish, right? Because if you only see the end goal and you don't know the story of this, the micro goals, the little mini goals that compounded on top of each other to reach millionaire status, you think that the dream is impossible. But really, there is 50 steps to attain before you can even become a millionaire. And those, that first step is maybe possible. And then you get the first step, you double up, you triple up, you quadruple, boom, 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 boom. That could be something really, really interesting, you know, that I mean, I'm really into like helping the kids out, you know, because yeah. I feel like it is possible for one generation to turn the whole family around. 100%. Take them from poverty to high society. It can happen.
And that's one of the reasons we love the Conor McGregors, right, is that they're emblematic of that exact idea.
He was a welfare guy.
Exactly. Working, was he wasn't the one cleaning, was he a janitor or something?
I don't know if he was a janitor, but GSP was a garbage man.
Yeah. That's crazy.
He was picking up garbage, man. Yeah. Literally a garbage picker. And he's a multimillionaire. Came from nothing. Came from literally from nothing, but he made it work. You know, and there are a lot of MMA stories like that, for sure, but also outside of MMA.
Absolutely.
You know, a lot of businessmen, a lot of smart guys, they open just a restaurant that was a brilliant idea, that's super well structured, and all of a sudden they have 6, 7, 8 of them. Like where I'm from, okay, a lot of guys have opened up breakfast chains. Like breakfast chains are huge in my area. Okay, let me tell you something. Every few years, there's a new hotspot breakfast place, okay?
Got it.
And there's one place that's called like Alamo Coco. Okay. And they started with one place and then they boomed to like 30 spots, which is incredible. You know what yeah. I mean? And these are just a couple of guys from my neighborhood when I was young and I'm going to see them at the restaurant. They're like, oh my God, Ava, nice to see you, blah, blah. I remember when you were 5 years old. I'm like, yeah, I remember when you were 12 and I was 5 and you were poor. And I look at this, you know, it's incredible. It's really, really cool. It's really, really cool. So, like, you know, those guys, they grew up with nothing. But there are a few friends that got together and they figured they were working in restaurants,
yeah,
right? Through family restaurants. And then they came up with their own breakfast idea. Boom, they turned it around. And then other guys who worked under them opened other restaurants, competitors, and those chains started going up. And then they're competing. And then guys who worked under the new guys got their own restaurant. And like now, if you come to Montreal, it's crazy how many amazing, high-end, very nice breakfast restaurants we have. It's like very cutthroat here. It's very cutthroat.
Can you guys come out this way? Because I feel like we have two out in BC.
Yeah. Oh, I'm telling you, you guys have nothing compared to us for breakfast. Yeah. Nothing. This is the spot for breakfast.
That's fantastic. Yeah. The other part about working with kids is like putting yourself out there and letting yourself be that role model is something I find, as you said, people are willing to do. Like I'm on council for my community, so I get to see the growth going on in the community and the development and the people who are really putting themselves out there. But there's almost this responsibility that mentors have, people with knowledge have, to go and share that wealth of knowledge and experience with others. And again, that's what makes fighters so interesting, is because you're willing to come on and share your story. But when I reach out to some professors or some dentists, it's kind of like, no, I don't want to go out into the spotlight. Like, I don't want that role. But that's kind of necessary in order for people to figure out how they fit into this world.
Yeah, I agree. And also, like, if you're a mentor, you want to teach them the real stuff. You want them to be successful, right? Why would you waste anybody's time? Yeah. You know, unless you're evil. You know what I mean? So, like, it's really important to then, once you realize you're a mentor, you have to continue doing what you're doing. And then also realize, what is it that I'm really doing? Because a lot of people, they're great, but they don't even know why. What are the small pieces that make them great?
Yeah.
And then they realize as they try to, you know, articulate it or pass on the knowledge, you know, like sometimes you see a lot of greats that their kids aren't great. It happens more often than not.
Yeah.
Not every great athlete or every great musician or every great entrepreneur passes that on. A lot of times their kids just end up being spoiled and or whatever, or become drug addicted, or like, just because you're a success doesn't mean you're going to be able to pass that on. You know, so I feel like even to be a good mentor, it takes a lot of deep self-reflection and understanding what makes you so great. And not a lot of people can articulate that or pass it on to anybody else.
Yeah, there's that difference between like when I first learned about old money and new money, and how like some people get the money and then they spend it immediately. Most people who win the lottery end up spending it instantly or misspending it because they've never known what it's like to manage that kind of money.
Yeah,
they don't end up succeeding. But the people who instill values in their kids, support them, teach them how to run businesses. I don't know if you've heard of Patrick Bet-David, but he talks
he talks a lot about this
in his interview with Chris Williamson about like, how do I support my kid in facing enough adversity where they're not like a spoiled brat, but not so much as I went through, where like I was literally striving to just keep food in the house.
I mean, as a parent, this is a very delicate balance, because I don't want my kids to think we're rich so much that they think that all the problems I can buy it, and then when they grow up they can expect me to solve their problems with money. I can just gonna throw money on it and buy their problem away. It doesn't work like that. You know, I want them to live without me eventually. Like, basically, I want this bird to fly. I want this bird to leave the nest. You know, that's the goal. Like, that's why I'm always trying to think in the future. Like, maybe my brothers, my cousins. My cousins are really good too. Like, we're always, you know, giving each other ideas because we all have kids different ages. So we talk about the experiences of each age and what they did as a solution and what they regret. You know, because sometimes the solutions that they came up with ended up backfiring, right? No one's perfect. You know, there are certain things you're going to get wrong. It's normal. But we also share it to give our other cousins a chance with their younger ones when they get there, right? So we're very open about discussing that kind of thing. And it's a very hard problem to solve, balancing how much you can give them and how much to withhold from them. But it's because if you withhold too much, you create a resentment, and then you're going to have to support them because they refuse to do anything. Or that you can give them so much that they're paralyzed to do anything.
Right?
So you have two opposite pitfalls here, and you got to skate through the middle, man. And it's not easy. It's not easy. So I'm still working on it. So it's a tough cookie to crack. I'm doing my best to keep them in the middle, but we'll see how it goes, man.
Beautiful. My last question, and I can't thank you enough for taking the time. I've learned so much, and I just enjoyed talking to you.
It's my pleasure to be here.
What's next for 2024? What are you hoping to see?
More fights, more money. I got problems. I got kids. No, kidding. No, definitely. I just want more fights. Two fights a year, three fights. Really excited to just like keep the ball rolling, keep it going. I'm really excited to just show more of what I can do. You know, that's what I really, my main goal for that. Like, for my career wise, is to put two fights in a year, three fights in a year. And in terms of family, you know, I'm doing some rentals in the house, make the living space even nicer. And just taking some trips with the kids whenever we can. Yeah, a lot of bonding, educating them, things like that, and keeping them on the straight and narrow, man. Keeping the kids on the straight and narrow, you know, just raising them. Raising them is, you know, it's one of my favorite things to do.
I'm so grateful. It's always such a pleasure chatting with you. Can you remind people how they can keep up to date with your journey?
Yeah, guys, you can follow me at Ariel Hawaii. No, kidding. At Eamon Zahavi on Instagram. And on the MMA Hour every Monday, I'm there. And that's it, just on Instagram. And also, guys, if you want to learn any of our skills, you can go on jujiclub.com and you can download some of my brother's instructional videos.
Can you spell that? Juji?
Juji Club. It's like jujitsu. It's J-U-J-I Club, C-L-U-B.com.
Okay. I'm going to sign up.
Yeah. It's not a monthly thing. It's like a per order. So let's say like a buy one DVD set, let's say about like leg locks.
Sure.
Or you buy one on like takedowns, one on unboxing.
Okay.
You know, so he sells like these different DVDs. Yeah, exactly.
Because crisp is you, but I think I can.
Yeah, you're going to get there, man. Yeah. Nice footwork. Actually, my brother teaches some really nice footwork skills. It's very important, right? Because you can't punch without feet.
Yeah.
You know, so you got to coordinate your hands and your feet together. So that'd be interesting, guys, if anybody's interested. And it's always a pleasure to be on here, Aaron. So I'm very grateful for you to have me on.
Well, I'm going to go start fasting now and get to work on my 72-hour fast. I'm going to do the cold plunge and then...
When you do the 72-hour fast, film your reaction to eating. That's what I want.
Okay?
Then maybe we can add it in the next interview after you tell me.
Yeah.
Then we can do a little clip. I would love to see it.
Okay, sounds good. We will run that.
Okay, great.
Thank you again for doing this.
Thank you very much.
I'm just smiling the whole time. It was amazing. Well done.
Yeah, it was great. I love being with you guys, man. You guys are the best. Honestly, like, it's very refreshing. You know, it's not always superficial stuff. You guys get to give me a chance for people to know me better. You know, and I really appreciate that.
You're just such a fun person. You've just got this energy. You got this smile. You got the energy.
Thank you. You too, man. You guys are great, man. I always feel welcome, and I feel very relaxed with you guys.
Okay, good.
I feel like you want to get the best out of me. There's no catch, you know? Yeah. So that's what makes me feel good.
Oh, I'm so happy to hear that. It means a lot coming from someone who's so thoughtful.
Thank you very much. You know, MMA community is very harsh. So you guys are great. Thank you.
Perfect. Well, enjoy the rest of your day. Tim, do you have anything else you want to follow up with?
No, I found it amazing. Interesting thing that twigged for me is with business, you have this built-in deadline. And so you can see your status or your accumulation as you go. This month's better than the last. And you come to December, if that's your year end, and you have that deadline built in. And I never thought about that in comparison to the New Year's resolution with no deadline. And so,
yeah, I mean, I think people miss the point. I feel like it's the opposite. Who cares about when you start?
Right.
When are we going to make it? Let's make it, you know?
A good point.
Yeah, thank you, sir.
Yeah.
Guys, have a great day. And if ever you want to do something else, maybe when I have a fight or whatever, you let me know. I'm all yours.
A fight? With you?
No, I mean, if before one of my fights.
Okay, yeah, yeah. No, that sounds great. Yeah,
I thought he just challenged you to a fight there. I was thinking you're...
Aaron, after the 72-hour fast, before your first meal, we're fighting. I want to get you nice and weak.
Okay, I was thinking it's a good thing you're on opposite ends of the country, if that's the case.
I'll move up to the Yukon to stay safe.
All right, guys, enjoy.
Sounds good.
Thank you.
Thank you, guys. Bye.
That was really, really good.
That was fantastic.
Yeah. I was thinking, boy, he's already interviewed him. I wonder what they'll talk about. But it was just amazing, just the way you kind of kicked it off from where you left off and then really dug into fitness, nutrition, and this whole deep dive into fasting was fascinating.
I learned a lot, and it's just motivating when you know somebody else has done it, and I kind of do it, and he's obviously doing it way better, so motivation for the new year, you know?
Cool, for sure.
What's your plan? What are your resolutions? What are your deadlines?
Well, now I realize I don't need resolutions. That's just my deadlines. Takeaway. From a personal aspect, COVID did a number on me. I used to work out regularly and then got away from it. And I used to walk a ton. And so I want to get back to that, which
you have a shower in the building, if I'm not mistaken, for all your workouts, right?
Exactly.
And how often does that thing get used?
Not very often lately. Wow. And so that actually allowed me to, I've read in air quotes more than 400 audiobooks. Because I did that while walking. And so I now have a whole bunch of credits on Audible and haven't been digging into that as much. So I'm going to get back to that.
Yeah, it seems like a great idea. Where do you walk? In the area or long distances to work?
Typically like a 5K walk around. I live off of the river on near Keith Wilson. So need to get back to that.
There you go. Well, I'll check in with you and we'll find out how that walking's going in the new year.
Sounds good.
Remember to like, subscribe, comment, do all the things. Send it to your friend. They need to know about this.
Yeah, this is a definite must-listen episode. However you consume Bigger Than Me.
Let's go.